KIOS FM presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by the Book Guys, veteran broadcaster Mike Cuthbert, Alan Stipek, senior appraiser for the Antiquarian Book Society, and Nick Basbains, author of Patience and Fortitude and A Gentle Madness. The title of their presentation is Fact and Fiction on the 40th Floor. It took place in the meeting room on the top floor of the First National Tower in downtown Omaha as a fundraising benefit for the Omaha Public Library Foundation, with proceeds benefiting Books for Kids. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday evening, May 6, 2003, for broadcast at this time. Recording and broadcast were made possible by funds provided by the listeners of KIOS-FM. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of KIOS-FM, the Omaha Public Library Foundation, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speakers is Marcy Cotton, president of the Omaha Public Library Foundation.
The Book Guys has been on the radio for quite a while, and I have enjoyed listening to them over the years and kept thinking, why don't they come to Omaha? Why not? And they'd be on the road to someplace like Reston, Virginia, or Williamsburg, Virginia, and periodically, because of a close friendship, Little Rock, Arkansas. And finally, I'd had enough. I said, guys, if you can go to Little Rock and you can go to Williamsburg, would you like to go on the road to Omaha? And they really replied with a very resounding yes, because it was the home of Marlon Perkins. And and today, thanks to Doc Simmons and Ann Rissmiller and Craig Jacobs and a few other people who helped to make it possible, they got to see the real true home of Marlon Perkins, and they had a great time at the zoo. I am about to turn this over to them, but I would like to tell you a bit of information I just learned from Marilee Miller, a gentleman who graduated a while ago, not that much of a while ago, I think we graduated in the same year, but in different high schools. Gary Friedman is a producer of a fairly prominent ABC network show. Is that right, Marilee? And he said, when he was just honored, that he owes everything he is and has become to the downtown Omaha Public Library system. And that is why we're here. We're really here to see that that standard is maintained and to keep Omaha the vibrant, vital, incredible place that it is, with a financial heart and a cultural soul. We need a great library. And I, again, want to thank you for being here, and I would like to turn this show over now to Michael Cuthbert, who is a host extraordinaire. So please welcome Michael Cuthbert.
Thanks, Marcy. I'm often asked about our love for books because it's obviously a factor. We wouldn't be doing this. And I have had some time this week to think about it. Our love for books is different and yet united. Alan has been in this business for generations now, over 20 years, and he is one of the country's outstanding appraisers of books, as you have heard. He loves the business end of it as well as the creative end of it. He loves what he gets into by the appraisals that he does, the places he has had access to, like the United States Supreme Court, and President's Archives, and Famous Scientists' Archives, and that excites him. Nick Basbains turns to jelly when he sees a copy of Galileo's most profound work with Galileo's notes. He can hardly move. He talks about the physical shock of picking up books that he has great respect for. I, on the other hand, have always wanted to write books. I love the physical process of writing and thinking up plots and stories. And finally, at an advanced age, I've been able to finagle myself into position to do the Book Guys, to do another show I'm very proud of called Primetime Radio for AARP, and now to write. I'm not sure if I'm going to be any good, but I don't, in a sense, care, because I love the writing and the reading that I have to do to become a writer. So in many different ways, the Book Guys have fallen in love with books and remain that way. One of the other reasons that I have come to love books and the Book Guys program is that because, in a way, almost by accident, people asking us, like Marcy did, to come to their town, We have met so damn many wonderful people. We are, though no one really cares too much except us, we are official Arkansas travelers. Granted that status by the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Arkansas. Now, to us, that's pretty special. That's fun. Now, you wouldn't think a bunch of sophisticated dudes from Washington and Boston would be impressed by being an Arkansas traveler, but it is part of the business that we do love, because the reason that we became Arkansas travelers was our love of books, which took us to Little Rock. It's our love of books that has also brought us here, where not only have we made great new friends and seen great books, including the $50,000 Federalist Papers that we saw this morning at the library, a stunning piece of literature and history. But we've also drafted a new member of the Book Guys. After this visit, on regular occasions, Tara Kennedy will be a book guy talking about conservation and preservation on our program. See, she has one thing in common with us, and by now you know what it is. She loves books. I don't know what it is about books that cause people to fall in love with them. I always love opening a new book just to smell the ink coming off the page. It's just, there's something bizarre and wonderful about that smell. On the other hand, there's an equally pungent aroma that you get when you walk into an old library where the books have been there for years, and where Nick has a wonderful story that I won't break, but there was a book just waiting for him for years that nobody else had read in a library because he hadn't read it. He hadn't come around yet. So that book patiently waited until he got there, and it contained the aroma of knowledge and excitement that all books contain, or all good books contain. So we're delighted to be the book guys. We happened entirely by accident. We happened to, as a matter of fact, we were reminded because of an animal that we saw at the zoo today, a Burmese python. My wife was in Georgetown many years ago when I was a talk show host on a commercial station in Washington. She came back knowing that I was desperate for guests and said, "You ought to have this guy. He wears a snake around his neck and he works at a bookstore. Now, in fact, he owns it." And I said, "Well, that's qualification enough for my show." Alan came on with me, and I had no idea what we were going to talk about, except that I knew one thing. He loved books, and I loved books, and that's where we started. Within about 10 minutes, we had sort of frittered away a lot of conversation, and a lonely light blinked on the console. And because I like to involve the public in my show, I said, "Well, let's see what this caller has in mind." I don't remember the book, but the caller said, "I have this old book that my aunt claimed is worth some money, and I wonder if she was telling me the truth or pulling my leg. Is this an inheritance or a joke? Did my aunt really love me or not?" So Alan, off the top of his head, because he had no books along to help him, he didn't know what was going to happen that night, appraised the book for the guy. The guy said, "Thank you very much." The odd thing was, by the time the call was halfway through, all of the other six lights on the console were blinking. And for an hour, we took call after call after call about books in the attic, books on the shelf. I always wondered about this book. What is a rare book? What is a used book? What is all this difference? And suddenly, we had an idea. Alan came back about every 2-3 months, and it always happened the same way. We'd get one call, and bang, the lights would line up. And, of course, as a talk show host, ambitious, but still with a certain degree of laziness, like most talk show hosts, I loved it because I didn't have to work at all. I just kept saying, "Sam, you're on the air," and Alan took over. I left town. I went to Cincinnati for radio. I came back to a non-commercial station, public radio, had Alan back on again, and with the public radio audience, it worked the same way. I left to go to Boston, came back to another commercial station in Washington. It worked still again. By now, people were saying when they heard the show, "You should do this nationally. You know, this could be a national show," and we said, "Okay." I went to work for Alan after leaving radio, formal radio, day-to-day radio, set up his computer system to market his online catalog, which at that time consisted of hardly any books at all. In fact, when it started, I was the only cataloger. I can remember the first 150 books that we put on the net. It took us about 3 or 4 days. But we had an unusual system. We cataloged online. So that as soon as I hit the enter button, that book was available to the public. Thanks to the bookminders.com and ABE and all the rest of them, we were able to upload our database, and now Second Story is a healthy participant in the internet, and I bailed on them. I left them because I wanted to write. I love books that much. So we are now in Omaha, where we've made so many new friends. It's just hard to imagine that in a day and a half we've made so many, and we've got more to make. I've had an incredible time because this morning someone walked down the aisle at the library, and I looked at what she was carrying, and it was my high school annual from 1958. And my first thought was, how did that woman get my annual? Well, Joyce Spillner Jones is a classmate of mine. We hadn't seen each other for 45 years. And we met here again in Omaha. Tomorrow at the Bookworm, I'm going to see someone I haven't seen for 30 years. My cousin married an airline pilot, went all over the world. I found out only a week ago she settled in Omaha. She read all the publicity material. My cousin Carolyn and I will meet after 30 years tomorrow at the Bookworm. So you wonder why I love coming to Omaha? Those memories will stay with us forever. And we thank you so much for the hospitality that we've had here. It's just been magnificent. And to be able to see the ski slopes in the distance, to see Schmidt's building without Schmidt, it's just been a real treat. Alan has some remarks to share with you, and so does Nick. So I'll turn it over to my all-time book guy, Alan Stipek.
Thank you. Marcy thanked everybody, and I wanted for us again to thank David and Nancy, David and Kim, and all the other people that were so gracious in hosting. Bruce and Kim. Having us here. I have to tell you that we have traveled around the country, we do a lot of shows, but we have never had a better produced show than the one that Marcy has done for us, and I would like everybody to give Marcy a round of applause. Well, she has done something extraordinary. Not only did she do it right, she brought the right people in with the right books, with the right attitude. And that's something we really love, because there's something we've seen in a lot of people that have come, the same love of books that we have, and that's the great thing about it. Mike talked about my relationship with Marlon Perkins, how I came to Omaha by talking to Marcy, and it's funny, because I come from Brooklyn, can't you guess, right? And I've been living in Washington since 1968. And when I was a kid, my father used to give me $2 to go down to the local bread shop to buy milk and bread, the newspapers, and come home for the Saturday breakfast. One day, I went down the street to buy the milk and bread, buy the papers, and in the window of the candy store. Now, I'm sure there's no candy stores in Omaha, but on every block in Brooklyn, there was at least one, was Marlon Perkins' Zoo Parade, a game that cost $1.49. I had $2. And I had to make a decision right on the spot. What was I going to do? So I decided to buy the papers because I knew my parents would want to read them. And I knew my sister would love to play Zoo Parade. So being the good older brother that I was, instead of buying the bread and the milk, I bought Zoo Parade. So for 2 days, we weren't allowed to eat because we wasted the money on Zoo Parade. But you know what? We had a great time. And so when I came to the zoo today, I could remember my parents from 1957 saying, Alan, you can't have any food for the weekend, okay? But it was well worth it. You have a marvelous zoo. As Mike said, he met me with a snake around my neck. It's a true story. I used to raise reptiles. I had a pet Burmese python, Ramon, which grew too big for me, who is now the largest snake in the National Zoo. So you wonder, how could a person like this become an appraiser for the Supreme Court, okay? Well, I opened Second Story Books when I was 23 years old in 1973. within about a five-year period, I realized that selling books was interesting, but there was something more important to just selling and buying books. It was the understanding of what the books were about that was the real important aspect of it. So I started to investigate the world of appraising. Living in Washington, we have some of the greatest libraries in the world. We have some of the greatest institutions. Within about a 10-year period, I had gotten contracts, relationships with most of the major institutions, the Smithsonian, worked for the White House since President Nixon all the way up to President Bush, have worked with the Supreme Court and a variety of different colleges and private libraries. And in that in this 30 years that I've worked, I have spent many, many hours working on some of the finest archives in the world. My highlight job was in the 1980s, I did Chief Justice Burger's personal archives of 1.5 million pieces of paper. I cannot tell you what's in them because I'm under a gag order by the Supreme Court that can only talk about it 11 years after the last justice who served with Chief Justice Burger either is deceased or has retired. Unfortunately, there's one Supreme Court justice who's younger than me, and we have a guarantee that we're going to outlive each other, so I'll never be able to talk about it. I thought that was the highlight of my career. The next day, I got a job by the Smithsonian, and I was appraising Tupperware. Now, this is a bit of a confusing reality to me, because here I worked under a very secure situation for the Supreme Court. I worked in Chief Justice Burger's personal office. I worked with Chief Justice Rehnquist and all of the other justices, a remarkable life experience. Then I go to the Smithsonian, where I have to appraise movies about Tupperware. And I said to myself, now this is one end of the spectrum. What happens next? And I realized that I had been working for about 2 years and had never met anybody that I had praised for because, unfortunately, they were all deceased. And I started to get somewhat depressed about that and saying, is this going to be the way I'm going to spend the rest of my life? Always appraising a great individual or an institute's valuable collections and never doing anything on my own which I would feel would be worthwhile other than appreciating somebody else's great works. My next assignment was to appraise Sir Alan Walters, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics in the field of microeconomics. Now, I happen to be an economics major from American University School of International Service. It's one of my two degrees. Microeconomics. Has anybody ever studied it in the audience? Has anybody been able to stay awake? Okay. I had it at 8 o'clock in the morning on Mondays. I mean, that is what happens to you when you're bad and you go to hell. That's what they make you do. So I had to, in fact, appraise this microeconomics collection. But lo and behold, Sir Alan was still alive and lived half of the time in Georgetown in D.C. and the other half of the time in Cambridge. And he happened to be in the Washington home at the time I got the job. So I was so happy that I was actually going to be working with a living individual that I drove over there, and something just came over me when I rang the doorbell and he came to the door. He greeted me, and I said, Sir Alan, you're alive. And without missing a beat, Sir Alan came back to me and says, I'm so happy that I am, son. And it was one of the most remarkable moments because we became very good friends. From that moment on, I started working very closely with Nobel Prize winners in the Washington area. I know that everybody here knows what DNA is, of course. Does everybody know who Dr. Marshall Nirenberg is, the person who decoded DNA? Dr. Nirenberg and I worked together on his papers, on the triplets, the decoding papers that he did, which were then put in the Smithsonian, and we became very close friends. One of the most interesting facets of my relationship with him was that he became very open with me. And one day, I went over to his house working on his papers, and he said, hey, I want to show you my Nobel Prize. Has anybody ever seen a Nobel Prize? It's the most impressive thing imaginable. You know where he kept it? In a shoebox. In a closet, behind a bunch of old clothes. And he shows me the Nobel Prize, and he says, this is not really what I want to show you. I want to show you this. And he pulls out a medal that he got from President Johnson in 1964. When he won the Nobel Prize, he was invited over to the White House. And he was asked by President Johnson to sit down and explain the concept of decoding DNA. So he starts explaining it to him in scientific terms, and he realizes within 3 minutes that President Johnson, A, doesn't have a clue what he's talking about, and B, really doesn't care, right? Now, President Johnson then says, thank you very much. I understand. I think what you're talking about. I want to give you a token of appreciation from the citizens of the United States. Opens the drawer, and this is Dr. Nirenberg telling me the story, and looks around and starts cursing. And President Johnson, as you know, had a very, let's say, interesting vocabulary. And Dr. Nirenberg is getting a little nervous because this man is getting more and more agitated and is cursing more and more, and he doesn't know what's going on. Finally, President Johnson turns to Dr. Nirenberg and says, I had a medal which was cast for you in honor of your discovery, but somebody here lost it. So instead, I'm going to give you this. Next week, I'm going to meet the president of Mexico, and we're going to make two cities, coexisting sister cities, on either side of the Rio Grande. And since I don't have the medal, I like to give you this Hands Across the Water medal, which I was going to give to the president of Mexico. So Dr. Nirenberg says to me, you know what? This is more important to me than the Nobel Prize, because it's got a better story, right? So about 4 weeks later, my daughter, who at the time is 8 years old, comes home from school and says, Dad, if I gave blood transfusion to an individual and that person committed a murder and they found blood on the scene of the murder of that individual and my DNA was in that blood, would I be convicted of murder? This is an 8-year old. Okay? And worried me because if this is the parental guidance she got from me, we're in a lot of trouble. So I said, you know, it's very interesting you brought that up because I'm going to be talking to Dr. Nirenberg about DNA tonight at 7 o'clock. Why don't I ask Dr. Nirenberg to answer that question for you? So I called Dr. Nirenberg up. I asked him if he would be willing to answer the question. He said, put your daughter on the phone, my daughter Lena. So Lena gets on the phone. And has anybody ever here seen the movie with Anne Margaret? What's the title of it? The one, Hugo's Going Steady with Kim. I just forgot. Bye Bye Birdie, excuse me, mental blank. You remember the opening scene where all the girls are singing, their legs are going up and down, everybody's nodding their head? There's my daughter on the phone with Nobel Prize, when 8 years old, with a portable phone with a leg going up and down for 20 minutes. So she gets off the phone and she said, you'll never believe what he's going to do. He's going to teach my science class next Wednesday by the internet from his office at NIH. So I get on the phone and I said, did you just commit to teaching a science class to a bunch of third graders in an elementary school in Poolsville, Maryland? He said, Alan, that's what it's all about. Anytime I can get the chance to teach a child, I've done something good for civilization. I'd rather do that than win a prize. And that was the thing that connected me to what I do. When I realized that the people that I appraise for, the collections that I'm able to see, puts it in that kind of perspective. There's so many decent individuals, people that we look at, that we respect in so many different fields, that have that humanity. That is what I think Nick and Mike will agree is what juices us up and wants us to come to cities like this to look at books, to interrelate, because there's always something out there, and there's always an individual. You never know who it is who's going to make that gesture, who's going to make that contribution, and it's going to do it in a way that you don't expect. And when it happens, it really reinforces your feeling of support in your community, in your country, in your libraries. And from that time on, you know, Mike will tell you also that we very actively try to pursue a variety of different projects on the book guys. Recently, we adopted the town of Plainview, Arkansas. 756 people? They don't have enough money for a library. So we started a public, plea for people to donate books. Recently, we received an email from them that they had received over $25,000 in cash contributions and over 10,000 books. And that they were thanking us for the work we did in helping them. Last week, we got a call from the Smith College Alumni Association in Baltimore. They're having their book sale, is it this weekend? The 16th. And they've committed every book that they do not sell to the Plainview, Arkansas Library. So all of a sudden, because they'll get 30 or 40,000 books in this book sale, and even on a good day, they'll only sell 35% of it. This library will have 50,000 books in their library by May 18th. And that's just because of the nature of the individuals who respect the libraries. And because of that, That gives us a feeling that we have attained something which is much more important than just telling you how much your book is worth, why is it worth $1,000, where can I sell it, how much can I get for it. You know, we really want to see people act in this philanthropic way. You don't have to give money, but time or giving books. I mean, just in your libraries alone, the books that you don't need to read or you don't want anymore, you don't need to go and sell them. Go out, find a public library that can use them. They can sell it themselves and use that money for library purchases. They can use it for maintenance. There are a variety of different ways that it can be used in a useful manner. So with that being said, I'm going to hand the mic over to Nick, who's going to talk to you about a very interesting story in Omaha.
All right. Okay, I'm holding the mic close. Before I get to the Omaha story, I have to tell you my favorite book guy's story. Mike and Alan both told you about how the program started, their colleagues and friends out of the Washington, D.C. area. Can you hear me all right back there? Very good. I wrote a book called A Gentle Madness. It was my first book. It was published in 1995. The subtitle was Bibliophiles. These are people who love books. Bibliomanes. These are people who are crazy about books. And The Eternal Passion for Books. Eternal passion for books. This book was published in 1995. I was invited to come to Washington to do a signing at the Washington Book Fair. That's where I met Alan. And he was walking around with his walkie-talkie and he was kind of brassy guy, I thought. And he told me about this. Really, right? I got that one wrong. And he told me he was thinking about, we got to be friends and we were chatting and he was telling me about this radio program he wanted to get started, The Book Guys. Why not? I said, you know, what they would do is they would do the program that they do, and for about 5 or 10 minutes into the show, they would give me a phone call up in Massachusetts, and I'd come on and talk about whatever I wanted to talk about, which was kind of fun. So we agreed to do that, and I've been doing this ever since. I don't think I've missed that many programs. Last year, I was giving a lecture at Duke University. Anyway, so it goes on, and we don't get it in Massachusetts for some reason. I don't know why. We have to work on that, but we do have a few NPR stations in New England that do carry it. So we really don't hear the programs in my area. So we tend to forget how popular it might get. It might be out in Omaha or Little Rock or California or wherever. Last year, I was giving a lecture down at Duke University in North Carolina. And you think that I would be introduced as the author of A Gentle Madness, finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, full-page review in the New York Times, full-page review in the Washington Post, or the author of Patience and Fortitude, the book that David McCullough said, I love me kind of stuff, right? This is how you get it in. But David McCullough wrote, Nicholas Bazbanes has become our leading author of books about books. You think that they would say this in the introduction. They said, no, this is Nick Bazbanes, who's heard weekly on The Book Guys here in Durham, North Carolina. And I said, you know, not bad. I said, okay, this is really very exciting. And I really am very, very proud to be regarded as a book guy. Mike and Alan have become great friends. And I think that the opportunity that we have had and that I have had to travel with them to Omaha, to Little Rock. We did a thing in San Francisco two years ago, just before Patience and Fortitude, by the way. I do tend to ramble around the block. And I have had a few queries today. What in the world is Patience and Fortitude? What has that got to do with books? For those of you who have not read the book, trust me, it's not a lost Jane Austen novel. Patience and Fortitude are the names of the lions that stand guard in front of the New York Public Library on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan in New York City, so named during the Great Depression when Fiorello LaGuardia, the charismatic mayor of New York, would give a Sunday evening radio address, and he would unfailingly end his remarks by saying, what we need to see us through the great ordeal which lay ahead are to exercise the twin virtues of patience and fortitude. And it became... Those became the names thenceforward for these lions, which I guess prior to that were Astor and Lennox, you know, after John Jacob Bass, two of the founders of the New York Public Library. I thought lions were really a wonderful, lions as guardians at the gates of knowledge. In this time when we're thinking about, when we hear all kinds of questions about the future of the printed book, what is the changing role of the library? These are issues that I do write about in all of my books in addition to collecting. And I thought this was a nice image, nice names. I have to tell you, my wife, who does a lot of work with me, a lot of research, we were casting about for a title for this book. This was my second book. Gentle Madness was easy. I'll talk about that in a bit. We were walking out of the Boston Public Library, which is the first legitimate public library in the United States, founded in 1850, built this particular building is a little later than that. But we were walking out of the building, and we're going down the stairway, the grand stairway, and we have our lions, too, in Boston. And my wife was so excited. She started grabbing my arm, and she couldn't really speak, but she's, you know, I was going to call the book, never mind what I was going to call it. It wasn't very good. And she's grabbing me, and she said, "The lions, the lions, the lions." And I said, "Oh, right, 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 Prudence and Felicity." I knew it. And I, that would be a Jane Austen title, too. That's why not? Why not Patience and Fortitude? That book really dealt in 12 chapters with book issues that kind of that picked up from where Gentle Madness left off, which was my first book. I'll briefly tell you, and then I will get to the Omaha story because it is wonderful, I think. And it brought me here 12 years ago to this wonderful city for reasons that are quite different from the reasons that brought, I'm laughing already, that brought me here yesterday. A Gentle Madness does derive its title from an expression given in an obituary for a man by the name of Isaiah Thomas, who was a great colonial and then federal printer. He was, in fact, in his time, the greatest printer, bookmaker of his era. Benjamin Franklin called him the Baskerville of America. He made Bibles. He had his own bindery. He was famous. He was fantastic. But what we remember him most for today is his book collection, his library, which became, in 1812, the American Antiquarian Society in Worcester, Massachusetts, which happens to be about where I live and work. The American Antiquarian Society was the first of a distinctively, I never use the word unique, but a distinctively American kind of an institution, which is a library that continues to have no relationship with any research, with any other educational institution, any university. It is an independent organization which was founded and established and has as its core collection the fruits of what a private collector put together. Isaiah Thomas was the greatest printer of his day. He wrote a book called The History of Printing in North America. It continues to be, after 180 years, the oldest book in continuous print in North America. We don't remember him for any of that. We remember him for the American Antiquarian Society. And when he died, his grandson said in tribute, "Grandfather was afflicted from the earliest of ages with that gentlest of infirmities. He was a bibliomaniac." And I will never forget that when I saw that title, I was casting about for a title. I was about to write this book about bibliomania through 25 centuries. And that was what became A Gentle Madness. Now, I begin as a journalist, as a storyteller. And as far as I'm concerned, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. If you can't tell a story to really animate what you're trying to do, what the point that you're trying to make, then I'm not going to get very many people to be interested in what I'm writing about. We will get to the Omaha story presently. There was a premise to A Gentle Madness. I wanted to write about how much we owe to these people, these possessed, eccentric people who have gone out to gather things, this passion to go out and gather and to preserve and to pass on, how so much of what we treasure, of our literature, our history, our culture, we would not have if it weren't for collectors. Now, that sounds perhaps like a preposterous premise, but I will give you a few quick examples. I don't know how many of you have been to the British Library, the new one or the old one, but if you walk into the British Library and you see there's one central case, they have 9 objects in there. Of those 9 objects, 5 have the name Cotton on it, Robert Cotton. There would be no Beowulf if it wasn't for Robert Cotton, the collector. There would be no Piers the Plowman. There would be no Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. There would be no Lindisfarne Gospels. Well, that's one great example of a collector who was gathering things after the dissolution of the monasteries in England, when they were going around and destroying the monasteries and the monastic libraries and destroying the books that were in there. This was one person who tried to preserve. He was a collector. He was impassioned by these things. He gathered, he preserved, he passed on. In Boston, up on Beacon Hill, right across the street from the State House, 2 doors up from the Union Club, we're talking about the Union Army, very, very important, at the Boston Athenaeum, we have the Confederate imprint collection, which is the standard by which every other Confederate imprint collection must be measured. There's nothing that comes close to it in Virginia, Texas, Mississippi. Anywhere you go in the United States of America, you will not find a better Confederate imprint collection than you do in Boston, 2 doors up from the Union Club. How was that? As the Civil War was coming to a close, Francis Parkman, the great historian, member of the Athenaeum, said, let's pass that Boston hat around. We have to get together some money. We have to go south. We have to go down there and gather up these imprints before they are suppressed, destroyed, or lost. And this is what they did, and they brought this collection back to Boston. Well, I thought I could do this. Not only could I do it over a period of 2,500 years, but as a journalist, to be able to go out and find the stories of today. And I do believe that I am the only person to date who has gone out and written about, I'm looking to Alan here for validation, but I think it's true. There are any number of books on book collecting through history, but I don't think there are many others that begin and to go out and try and tell you about the great collecting stories of today. Now, Gentle Madness was published in 1995, and how do you explain chapter 13 of A Gentle Madness, which is called The Blumberg Collection? Now, I don't know how many of you have read my book. It sounds like a very straightforward title, but this is what brings me here to Omaha in 1991. Stephen Carey Blumberg is a collector. He's in his late 50s now. He put together a rather remarkable collection. And in 1990, a squadron of 17 FBI agents broke into his home in Ottumwa, Iowa, and recovered 23,000 books, which he had gathered from 368 libraries in 45 states, two Canadian provinces, and the District of Columbia, fully 95% of which were never known to be missing until the day he was arrested. So we do have security issues that come to the fore here. We're not just talking about books. We're talking about Claremont College's own copy of the Nuremberg Chronicle, a magnificent book published in 1493, The Last History of the World, printed before the discovery of America. And the person who put this book out, by the way, very very wisely left some blank pages at the end of the book, sort of like, you know, if you want to put in current events or breaking events. And you talk about a magnificently produced book, which was eclipsed within a matter of months by the Columbus letter, the letter that Christopher Columbus writes upon his return, same year, 1493, about this discovery, shabbily printed thing. Well, Stephen had one of those, too. He also had the state of Connecticut's own copy of the first book printed in Connecticut. He got that from the Connecticut State Library. He had the Zamorano Club of California's own collection of the Zamorano 80. He got those out of USC. Anyway, when I was working on my book, this was 1990, I pick up a copy of the newspaper and I see that the previous evening these 17 FBI agents had gone into this house in Ottumwa, not far from here, right to the east, I'm pointing to the east, in an old Victorian house. These 22,000 books filled up two semi-trailer tractor trucks and brought them out here to Omaha, Nebraska, and had installed them in what was known as a secret warehouse. I had desperately wanted to come and see these books. Now, I went to the trial, by the way. Stephen was indicted. And as far as I can determine, he is the only person in the history of American jurisprudence to be charged on charges of what amount to criminal bibliomania. I mean, his defense. Now, this is a book that, to go back to my title, A Gentle Madness, which was my immediate title from the very beginning. This book took me 8 years to write, by the way. The first contract that I had with Random House was for 90,000 words for a manuscript to be delivered in 18 months. Random House got tired after a while of waiting. It took 8 years, and it was a 300,000-word manuscript, which came out in 1995. Well, you know, it was worth waiting for, I thought. In any case, the books came out here. They put them into the warehouse. I went to the trial in Des Moines, by the way, got to know Stephen. He wouldn't talk to anybody, but who is this guy, me, you know, walking around? Everybody wanted to talk to him about this crime, you know, who is this guy who would climb up elevator shafts? Who is this guy that would dress up as a professor? That would get he was a master locksmith. He would get, I'll be happy to tell you how he made his own keys. Entered into evidence at the trial were more than 150 keys that he had been able to go walk into these libraries. He would find who the head of special collections was. He would find out who the head librarian was. He would get that key. He'd make a copy. Then he'd come back at night. He knew how to go around security systems. But he was a collector. Guess what? He took these books. If he were just a thief, you see, he would not have been of any interest to me at all. I mean, there are many, many book thieves who not only steal books but desecrate books, who tear them up. Stephen loved his books. I'm not trying to explain away anything that he did. His defense at trial, however, in a book, now this book is already titled A Gentle Madness. His defense at trial was not guilty by reason of insanity. And you know what? I thought it was a pretty valid defense. I mean, I got to know this guy. And I arrived. He was a collector. He loved books. What's this guy doing in a book about books that purports to be writing about the most productive aspects of bibliomania, how much we owe to these people, how much... I'm laughing. I also felt, well, first of all, you have a great story here, but there is something instructive to have to write about the collector who kind of goes over the cliff. I mean, the excessive example. But beyond that, he was a great story. And he continues to be the one story people always want to know about. Well, the books came out here. I went to the trial. I would walk the hallways during recesses. After he came up to me one day, he said, "Who the hell are you?" And I said, "I'm a writer from Massachusetts. I'm here to write about book collectors." He looked at me. He said, "You're writing about book collectors?" I said, "Oh, yes, I'm writing a book about book collectors." I said, "I'm going to put you in a book with Henry Huntington, Henry Clay Folger, Pierpont Morgan, Robert Hoe." And that got his attention right there. And so we began to talk during recesses, and he'd say, "You know, we're the only two people." He had a scratchy voice. He said, "You and I are the only two people in this room who know anything about points." He said, "You know how many incunables?" You know what an incunable is? It's a book that was printed during the 1400s at the invention of print. The word incunabulum comes from a Latin phrase which means from the cradle. It was from the cradle of printing. These are the earliest printed books from 1450 through 1500. He said, "You know how many incunables I had? 100. He said, "Not bad to put together a collection of 100 incunables at this stage in the 20th century with very limited funds. I mean, he... The Nuremberg Chronicle is an incunable, in fact. So we got to talk. One Saturday, he was out on bail. He was, by the way, prohibited from going within 100 yards of any library, bookstore, or museum. And he invited me to spend a day with him. And, of course, I said, how quickly would you be able to pick me up? And it was 10 minutes later, and we drove from Des Moines down to Ottumwa. And I kept the tape recorder running the whole way, 7.5 hours of tape-recorded interview conversation, which to this day, 10 years later, is still the only interview he's ever given anyone. He took me down to Ottumwa. We went to the house, and then we went to his warehouse. He is a person of some independent means, but to see him on the street, you'd never know it. He looks like a homeless person. He dresses like a homeless person. The FBI had some hygienic problems with him. He smells like he could probably use a bath, but they did tell him to clean up a little bit for the trial. I have to say, when we were driving down to Ottumwa, he screamed his old Cadillac off the road. I said, "What the heck is this guy doing?" And he dove headfirst into this dumpster. He's a dumpster diver. And if you look in Gentle Madness, you'll see a picture. I said, I thank the good Lord up there because I had my camera with me. And I saw this thing rumbling around, and this fellow comes out of the top of the dumpster. And there he is with a book. I mean, you couldn't have scripted this thing. And it turns out to be a pretty interesting, valuable book that's worth about $150. I mean, and he hadn't been to Ottumwa since his arrest. And I think he's only been back once since I'm jumping ahead. He didn't win the trial. I mean, he was convicted in about 20 minutes. And he did do 7 years. And he did move around from prison to prison the first time because books began to disappear from the prison library. That's a true story. Out here in the Midwest, in fact.
Say what?
No, okay. I'm sorry. He did take me over to the warehouse. I'll tell you the quick doorknob story. Stephen began collecting books. He said it was a research collection. This man is really one of the great living authorities on American architecture, antiques, fixtures, and he had 50,000 doorknobs crated in this warehouse in Ottumwa. We went over there. They were all stacked in plastic. I have pictures of these things. All of these milk cartons filled with doorknobs. And he said to me, "Would you like a memento of our day together?" And I said, I would. And he grabbed a doorknob out of the plastic box, and he said, oh, this is a beauty. He said, Robinson Brothers, Reading, Pennsylvania, 1878, knew exactly what it was. And he gave it to me. I said, well, Stephen, I'll accept it, but, I mean, is this stolen, you know? He said, no, they only charged me with the books. Don't worry about it. And so I said, fine, I'll take it. And when I got back to Des Moines, I called the FBI agent, who happened to be based out here in Omaha, Dennis Aiken. And I said, listen, I have to tell you, I said, Stephen Blumper gave me a doorknob. I said, are you guys going to give me any hassle about receiving stolen property? He said, don't worry about it. We only charged him with the books. So he was absolutely right. So I came here. Meanwhile, now he was convicted. But to really write this story properly, I felt I really had. I'm one of these writers that, you know, you can do things on the telephone, you can do research in libraries, but you still have to go and see things. You have to go and feel things. You have to go and smell things. I'm one of these writers that has to go and touch. And it was so imperative for me to come out here to Omaha and to go into that warehouse where nobody had been allowed inside to see any of these books. And I had been badgering the FBI agent for months to please let me come and see the books. He said, what in the world do you want to come out to Omaha for? He says, all you're going to see is something that looks like an old library. Like he didn't get it, you know. No kidding. So finally, when he was sentenced, I immediately called the agent out here. And I said, guess what? I told him what the sentence was. I said, now can I come in and see the books? He said, all right, I'll give you 15 minutes. So I flew. I said, fine, I'll take the 15. I flew from Boston to Omaha. He said he told me where to meet him out in Interstate 80 at a McDonald's under a flagpole. I got there. I knew it was, I mean, you can tell an FBI guy from a mile away. He was sitting, watching me. I was waiting. I took a taxi. Finally, he beeped the horn. I get in the car. He said, don't worry, I'm not going to blindfold you. I said, that's fine. I said, you have no problems with me. But he did take me. I don't recall where it was. We drove around, and we went to this warehouse here in Omaha. And you wonder why it's so important to go in and see the books. I knew what the books were. I already had the catalog for the books. I knew these books were valued at $20 million, by the way. And what's remarkable is he stole them because he loved them. He was a collector. But if you read that opening passage in my chapter, chapter 13, I walk into this room and there are these FBI agents and there are these twinkling lights and these all kinds of these security devices. What impressed me most of all, we talk about, Alan used the word earlier today, provenance. You know, where a book comes from. You walk into this warehouse, and it's not so much the books, but it's the little stenciled signs, which are Harvard, Library of Congress, University of Wisconsin, University of Southern California. You know, the books that they had determined belonged to all these different places. Now, what made this very, very difficult is the one desecration that Blumberg did do to these books is that he removed the book plates. I guess he as he said to me at one point, we were driving back to Des Moines that night, he said, turn off your tape recorder. I turned off my tape recorder. He said, you know what? The one chip that I have is that I know where they all came from. I said, okay. He said, you know the Uncle Tom's cabin they think I got from Harvard? He shook his head. He said, USC, University of Southern California. But, you know, that little chip, like so many other playing chips, because of people here at Creighton University, by the way, and let me say, because there were people here from Creighton and also some librarians from the public library here, actually a whole battalion, squadrons of librarians, volunteered their work to the federal government, to the FBI, and went and worked here in the warehouse, wherever it is. I mean, I wasn't blindfolded, but I certainly couldn't lead you there. And there is quite an interesting videotape that was made by the OCLC about these Omaha librarians who worked on this project. It's called the Omaha Project, in fact, is what the tape is called, and how they helped determine where most of these books belonged, to whom they belonged. Because, as I said, 95% of these books that were stolen were never known to be missing until the day they were recovered. A fellow from Duke University came out here. He thought maybe they lost some books. And so he was out here going through the warehouse looking through some of these books. It happened to be that Stephen there was, he was there that day because part of his deal with the, no deal, but he was hoping to get a lesser sentence. I'll help you determine where the books, am I going too long?
Yes.
Okay, I'll wrap it up. I'll just wrap it up with this quick little story. Stephen sees the man from Duke. He walks up. He introduces himself. He says, I loved your campus. It's a beautiful place. He says, who the hell are you? I mean, who is this guy? He said, you never took any books from us, did you? He said, well, he said, when's the last time you saw your 4 millionth book? The 4 millionth book, you know, he said, oh, my God, I've been looking for this book. He goes, he calls his associate. They go down. Fine. Now they know the title. They find it. He comes back. He says, I also have your 5 millionth book. He says, I also have the Flowers collection, 350 books. And so then, you know, you talk about, and then it's not so funny anymore because it does at that point become kind of a cultural felony. These books had been removed. People were no longer able to use them. And in fact, if he hadn't been arrested and stopped, these books wouldn't be. Well, that's my little Omaha story. I do have another book coming out this fall. I recommend it to you with all shameless immodesty. The title is A Splendor of Letters, The Permanence of Books in an Impermanent World, and it more or less completes this trilogy of books, A Gentle Madness, Patience and Fortitude, and I will be doing a few others. And thank you so much for inviting me.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by the Book Guys, veteran broadcaster Mike Cuthbert, Alan Stipek, senior appraiser for the Antiquarian Book Society, and Nick Basbains, author of Patience and Fortitude and A Gentle Madness. The title of their presentation was Fact and Fiction on the 40th Floor. It took place in the meeting room on the top floor of the First National Tower in downtown Omaha as a fundraising benefit for the Omaha Public Library Foundation, with proceeds benefiting Books for Kids. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday evening, May 6, 2003, for broadcast at this time. Recording and broadcast were made possible by funds provided by the listeners of KIOS-FM. Special thanks to Omaha Public Library Foundation President Marcy Cotton for her help in making the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Special thanks also to Linda Trout and Rhodey Extraordinaire Mary Marchio from the Omaha Public Library for coordinating the Book Guys recordings and for providing invaluable technical assistance during their visit. Be sure and listen next Friday morning, May 23rd at 10 o'clock, for the second program recorded by the Book Guys during their visit to Omaha. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.